So you're going to be here in Raglan tomorrow morning, Saturday morning at 10 o'clock for a workshop slash conversation, it says here, about economies for people, not profits. Perhaps we should start just right away with what does that mean, economies for people, not profit?
Well, it's funny. It's hard to know where to start there. many years ago, we had a meeting in Raglan to kick off the savings pools. And Phil worked out that Raglan had around about $20 million a year being sucked out of the local economy because of the gross debt of all the mortgages and everything in the area, and that all of this money is going offshore. And, you know, the reality is that things are looking a bit dire at the moment, and we're moving into a period of chaos. And chaos is where community becomes imperative and has the ability to grow really quickly. And so having a local economy, an economy based on exchanges within a region, is much more reliable than waiting for central government to sort things out. So the whole thing since, what is it, 1984 with Rogernomics and so on, and neoliberalism, has meant that the growth of the systems which today are responsible for climate change. So we really have to change the way we do our exchanges and localize. And so economy is actually about how we do exchanges. And so that's what the conversation will be about. And it can be about time banks, it can be about savings pools, it can be about making local currencies, it can be about just cooperative behaviour. And that also means access to land, which is ridiculously expensive too.
Yeah, so the maybe one way of saying it is about creating some kind of economic systems that exist outside of the main one, which, as you say, is sucking huge amounts of money out of our community and every community, and is probably, ignoring for a moment what's happened with land prices, but it's probably responsible for the fact that we've gone from a country where a family could survive on one income to two incomes, and now some families not really able to survive even on two incomes.
That's right, or even three incomes in some cases.
Yeah, I didn't want to go there because that seems a little bit mathematically impossible, but yeah.
I know, it does, but yeah, that's true. We have had a huge transition, but this is actually a global phenomenon, and the corresponding carbon emissions. When you have economies that grow exponentially, what they're doing is fueling resource use, because a growing economy needs resources, and that means coal, oil, gas, and so on, and that is a major global problem, and we just have to back off from there. We can live actually gracefully and happily on a huge reduction on our resource use. We're not living within our means or the Earth's means, and we need to be localizing dramatically. Yeah,
it seems like the big machine that is the worldwide economic system is not going to slow itself down. Or it even shows much interest in it. So what are you attempting to do here? Are you creating something outside of that?
Yes, we're really actually just having conversations about, Joe and I went to Sweden and learned how to do interest-free finance and set up the savings pool system in New Zealand. And some people want to know about that, and that's so we can talk about that. And in fact, there's a game that you can play which effectively demonstrates how it works, and it's quite an interesting experience to go through an idea that you can substitute substitute reciprocity for interest, and that is a zero growth system.
Do you want to explain what you found in Sweden when you went there? Well, I mean, you knew it was going to be there when you went, but what is happening there?
There's a bank called the JAK Bank, which has been going since the 70s. It started off with a sort of a funding that was philanthropic, and it was lending at zero interest. And the husband, a guy called Per Almgren, who the husband of a board member, was an engineer, and quickly realized that a bank can be like a pond. You can take as much water as you like out of the pond as long as the same amount is going in. And so he designed a system, because the philanthropy supported bank obviously had limits. There are limits to philanthropy. So he designed a system where when you borrowed money, you repaid, and half of what you were repaying was your loan repayment, and half of it was a contribution into the pool. So you actually took twice as long to repay it, but at the end, you were able to withdraw a lump sum equal to the amount that you'd borrowed, and that money had been servicing other people's loans in the meantime. And if everybody is doing that, then nobody's paying interest, and the financial requirements of the people who are contributing to that bank are all met. And in fact, they grow quite large. And when Joe and I came back from Sweden, we decided to tip the whole banking system upside down, because we knew we couldn't start a bank in New Zealand, and vest the fundamental principles in agreements between clusters of people. And so around New Zealand at the moment, there are many small clusters, like between 8 and 30 people, who have it's sort of like a shared economy. And every time someone borrows money, well, they need to make a bigger contribution back into the pool. So the pool expands, and there's more money in it for other people to borrow. And it just rapidly grows, and people's ability to cancel all their credit cards they get it's like a pause button on discretionary spending. If you don't have a credit card, then you think about it and think, well, do I really need this? If I do, then I can get the money from my savings pool. And that's what's been happening around the country for quite some time now. It's perfectly legal. We've actually been checked out by the FMA some years ago, and it's based on basic principles that have been the basis of society for hundreds of years, if not thousands. You know, reciprocity, the freedom to make agreements between people, things like that, that are just fundamental, and actually the basis of commercial law today.
So, can I? There's something I want to check, Brian. So, the money, I guess the way I look at it, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that the money that if you normally get a loan from a bank, the money you would normally be paying as interest to the bank is the extra money equivalent, the extra money that you're paying into the savings pool, and that money is used to benefit the rest of the pool, but you get it back if you want it back at the end of the process.
It's not quite that simple. If you borrow from the bank, the bank actually to start with didn't have any money, and you're active signing up to pay the bank money, means that they can lodge it in your account and you are obliged to pay it to them.
Yeah.
So you're creating money when you spend it.
Yep.
Now, with the savings pool, what we're doing is saying it's equal give and take. So if I'm borrowing $100 over a year, it's sort of approximately $2 a week, and it's paid back. But in actual fact, you pay your $2 a week back for 2 years, and at the end of that time, you've paid off your loan and you've saved $100. And that's basically how it works. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. I was trying to distill it down into like a simple statement for people. I guess the key thing, because I've heard you talk about it before, and I think the key thing for me is that idea that people are paying extra over and above paying their loan back. They're paying that into the pool, and that benefits the pool and keeps it going. But ultimately, people do get that money back.
Absolutely, yes. In fact, I often get calls from people really happy because when they're paid off, they've got this huge lump sum, which means that they can do the next step in their lives and they can still borrow money from the pool if they want to. So it's a real shot in the arm.
Do people tend to immediately take the money out of the pool, or do sometimes they leave it in the pool for a while?
Both. So some people take the money out of the pool or take most of their money out of the pool. Others leave it in the pool because they've got ideas of what they want to do next. And it's we have what's called savings points, which are a recognition of advanced savings or advanced contributions into the pool. So that's recognized in the system. And that means that when you come to borrow next, then your contributions, your reciprocity contributions can be a lot less. There are people who put in significant amounts of money up front in the knowledge that they'll be borrowing at some point in the future, and other people who would just don't want to support the banking system.
Mm.
And want to support their local economy, and that's the economy of the people in the pool.
So you mentioned before that the FMA checked it out. Did they kind of hear about you guys and think that something suspect was happening?
Yes. Yeah, it was on one of the TV news items about it. And so they heard about it and contacted us and asked us to go through a process where we get a lawyer who's specializes in finance to do a report on exactly what we're doing, and that they would receive this report and then decide whether or not we're contravening anything. And the lawyer, when she went through it, was quite excited about it, because actually it doesn't break any laws whatsoever, and it was really very interesting as a concept for her. And it went back to the FMA. The FMA said, well, you don't seem to be breaking any laws, but we would like to know how much money is going into the pools and how many pools there are. Well, the savings pools are set up as autonomous cells. So
right.
I don't know anything about the membership of any pool other than the ones I'm in. I'm in two pools. And I don't know how much money is going into any of the other pools. And so I'm simply unable to answer those questions because they're covered by confidentiality, and there's no central. It's not a centralized system. It's more like a whole lot of unique cells spread around the country. And in fact, sometimes the first time I hear about the existence of pools is I get a call asking, "Well, are we doing the right thing here?" They've heard about it, got on with it, and and then realised, oh, are we actually working this out right so it's fair? And then they contact us and we can advise them and say this is what you should be doing. So these pools are not, they're totally private. They're not, and not only are they totally private, but they are not legal entities. In other words, a bit like having a club rather than having a company.
Yeah.
And so they're not covered by any government legislation whatsoever. And basically, they don't get a look in, and nor do the banks really, because all they have is a bank account number. Each pool has a bank account, and that's the only information that there is in either the banking domain or the government domain. It's just not available. There's no profit, so there's no tax. All those sorts of things. Yeah.
So I know we've got a couple of saving pools in our community here, and quite a few years ago now, I did talk to, there was someone I was interviewing regularly about something else, and then one time we talked about just his experience in the saving pools and the kind of the close-knit community that develops in it. But where I wanted to go from here is, like, you're in Raglan tomorrow. So and we've already got savings pools. So what are you hoping to achieve or work on or just discuss, have a conversation about this time?
Well, the Time Bank recognised that their membership were interested in local economy, and they thought that it would be a good idea to look at what are the options for improving the local economy, and those options include savings pools. They include setting up local currencies or voucher systems. They include conscious thinking about how to do things cooperatively, producing food, health systems, all of that sort of thing. So we are going to be responding more to what the people are interested in talking about than... I don't have an agenda myself. I'm just interested in supporting people's investigation into how to build local economy. And local economy will build, especially, you know, as things... well, you know, people are having struggles with the health system, the nurses and the teachers at schools, or everybody is finding that things are a real struggle. And when you get that sort of chaos emerging, that's also when community becomes strong. Yeah. And so people are looking for community solutions, and that's what the conversations will be about. And if people want specifically to know about savings pools, I'm certainly happy to help with that, and we, as I said, we've got a game which can demonstrate how they work, so that you get that aha sort of a sense. When it's not an intellectual thing, it's just a game like Monopoly that you can play and learn from.
So let's just talk about you had something else?
No, that's it, yeah.
Okay. A local currency, a thing that could potentially be called a Raglan coin, but people might want to call it something else that's just one word.
Yep.
People often say, they talk about local currencies, and I hear people say, oh, it's a great idea, but it's really hard to get the businesses, and then money piles up on one side and not the other, and there's, you know, people see problems. Do you have answers to some of that?
Yeah, sure. You know, the pools that I know of that have been really successful are pools that come from a place of generosity of spirit. And so the thing about it is not seeing money as my individual ownership of money. It's about seeing how can what I do serve my community, and I have a vested interest in everybody in my community being genuinely well looked after. And so, you know, those pools that have that sort of ethic of being generous and caring have the least problem with money building up. And also, pools are in a position where they can support other pools. And so we have a system of administration of pools, and there are some people who actually administer multiple numbers of pools, and they can put pools in touch with each other. And so money can go from pools that have got a surplus to pools which have got a lot of people who need money. And the relationship between the pools is also based on reciprocity, so that when money goes to support another pool, then it gets repaid as well as reciprocity goes, so that more money comes back into the pool which has been lending to another pool. So it works on that bigger level as well.
So that same concept works with a local currency, and the sense that the community is in it together.
Well, that's savings pools. A local currency, you've got, we used to have a lot of LETS systems, local energy trading systems, I think that means,
yeah.
Or green dollars all around the country. And they work best when they are fully featured, when they've got the dentist, the doctor, the you know, whatever. What tends to happen, I think you identified there, is that some people in LETS systems find it easy to accumulate green dollars, but do not find that the services that are on offer meet their needs, and so it becomes lopsided, and that is a more tricky situation. Other communities have actually printed voucher systems which are backed by their local businesses, and so they're a bit like the Whitcools book vouchers, or say you know, the airline points, or
yep,
whatever, where you can use them, and they effectively can stand in for money. It's what your imagination, that is the only limit. You know, in some countries, these systems have been backed by coal and coal mines. When a business wants to say you in Raglan, you wanted to set up some windmills, then if they were community owned, then the contributors would be able to receive vouchers from the organisation that builds the windmill, then the vouchers would be redeemable in terms of energy. And those vouchers could also go into circulation in the local community, and they stand for money because everybody uses energy. And
right,
so that's, you right, know, there's lots of different ways of backing money. It used to be that money was backed by gold, but of course gold's got to be backed by people's willingness to use it, whereas energy, everyone needs. It's a better backing than gold.
So that's the basic idea of the original LETS.
The original LETS was set up as an accounting system where people could have, say, $500 credit or $50 or whatever it was, and that they had to return their account to zero at least once a year, and people were expected, if they got that limit with what they're into their account, they were expected to spend it. And that meant that it was the account for the community was revolving around zero all the time. But it just didn't seem to work that well. It does work, but it tends to destabilize after a while. I know I was a member of a LET system for a long time, Joe and I were, and we grew organic garlic and had organic honey, and everyone wanted honey and garlic, but in our area there weren't many people who were willing to supply labour or chook food or the sorts of things that we needed. So it didn't work that well for us, and that's where that instability of the system starts to creep in over time.
Yeah. Are there possibilities of now, because of we've got blockchain technology, Bitcoin's the one that most people have heard of, but it's a concept that can be used for all sorts of things. Can that help?
That's being investigated, and there are lots of blockchain systems evolving. Most of them are centralized in the sense that there are people who code them and who manage them. And just like our banking system is centralized, Bitcoin itself is not centralized. There's no one who runs it. It just runs loose. It's fairly volatile, but then so is our national currency fairly volatile. And if you're willing to ride with that volatility, then it works in the long term. But if in the short term, it's not safe. In the long term, I think it is. But setting up a blockchain approach to local currencies is still it's reliant on someone administering it, and that is its weakness. But then, you know, if you have a local system that's run by local people, then they are accountable to their community, and that you know, I support that. That's absolutely how it should be. But I don't put my head in there because I'm not of the generation where I'm a digital native.
Right. So, folks, we're talking to Brian Innes and about alternative economic thinking, I guess. You're part of Living Economies. I know you and your partner Joe set up the Eco Show many years ago, and I remember going to those and enjoying those. And you've been involved in permaculture as well. How does permaculture lead to this, or is that not a very important question?
Oh yeah, no, permaculture totally. It's like Bill Mollison back in the 1970s. Came up with this idea of permaculture, and that everything has a structure. You know, even natural systems are all structured with relationships, exchanges, and you know, energy exchanges are happening in every part of all living systems. And he recognized the need to design what he called invisible structures, and that with human beings, we are part of nature, and what we need to do with our structures is design them so that they actually mimic nature in the way it works. And so reciprocity is something that goes on in the soil all the time between plants and fungi and trees. And, you know, these are just natural systems that run on systems that we could be doing at an extensive level in human society. But what we tend to do is well, the use of fossil fuels is the biggie, but we also have systems that are too big. And when you centralise and centralise and centralise, you lose control at the detailed level, and so you have overfishing and you have pollution and over resource use. And really we have to get back to having communities and in control of their own resources, and that's part of permaculture, you know.
Right, okay, that answers that well. One of the other things that is a potential thing for you guys to talk about on Saturday is I see land trusts, and I guess if we explain it, the first thing people are going to say is, okay, but how do you get hold of your piece of land to start with?
Well, there's sort of... we get approached by people from time to time who've sold a house in Auckland or somewhere, or who are just at the end of life and don't have children and grandchildren and wanting to figure out, well, what can we do with our resources? And, you know, you only need 10 people with $100,000 to have $1 million. And, sure, you can't buy a farm for $1 million these days, but you can for a few million dollars. And a bunch of people, like farmland, costs somewhere around about $30,000 to $50,000 a hectare, which is minuscule compared with urban land. And you may have noticed that industrial companies in Auckland are starting to move out of Auckland onto farmland and set up their own little villages. So,
we're getting one near here in a while. Yeah. And the Waikato district.
What's available for an industrial setup is equally available for citizens, and so getting a bunch of people together to buy a farm, and you know, we also have this system of it's now perfectly recognised as perfectly legal to have tiny homes and things like that. So the first step on the rung of ownership of your own home and a very low cost in terms of trusts, if you set up land trusts, because the land has not cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to start with before you even have a home, your overheads are very small. And like, I live in a community, there are probably about 50 people in that community now. It's slowly grown for the last 40 years. It's on rural land. We do not have mortgages. We do not pay for electricity. We do not pay for water. We have a small amount for our collective costs of running a hall and things like that. So our cost of living is minuscule compared with an urban dweller's. And we really live well because and have often very time-rich lifestyles. That actually is available. And unless we can liberate some of this aggregated rural land for the use of people who have actually migrated from the country to the cities, if we can reverse that, we can get back to a much more sustainable basis of living.
So you mentioned like you live in an intentional community. Does it a land trust... doesn't necessarily have to be the home of an actual intentional community, does it? I'm guessing.
We have our the Industrial Providential Societies Act, and then there's I can't remember offhand, but my wife does that sort of thing. It's legislation that came from Britain, and it was written in New Zealand in, I think, 1905, and it still operates. And it was the fundamentals on which Fonterra was built. And, with cooperatives, you can have either shareholding or undivided shareholding so that it's no longer shareholding. And actually, that's the, I think, the best legislation to have land ownership of a land trust. And that means that it never returns to the marketplace, and it's not subject to inflation. So people's costs are only their individual housing costs, and they own their own houses on this piece of land. That's by agreement of the people in the community. But, you know, basically, the notion of agreement is something that goes back literally thousands and thousands of years and is the basis of our law in New Zealand for commerce. And we can have whatever we agree upon. So I'm not suggesting that everybody has to do what our intentional community has done. People do all sorts of things. But the further you can step away from individual land ownership, the lower the costs are for each generation. And in fact, in 1870, a guy called Henry George wrote a book about that, and it was the sort of the ferment of the labor movement was around his writings. And the kibbutz system in Israel was set up around the work of Henry George and leasehold land. And Taiwan has a huge amount of land that's owned by the government, not by individuals. It's leasehold land. And that's one of the reasons that Taiwan is a prosperous country. So, if you want to buy a house in Motueka, you pay half the amount if it's a Maori lease land. And you can own the house, but you don't own the land. You pay a small lease. And the ownership can be invested in the people who live on the land, or it can be vested in a trust that goes about creating more and more trusts. So it's just the limit is your imagination.
A question, I've never lived on leasehold land. They have time periods. What happens at the end of the time period? I've never known the answer to that question. Do you have to leave?
No. They just have a right of renewal. And, the people, if the people who are living on the land are the members of the trust which owns the land, then, of course, they're not going to sell the land or disrupt their own relationships. They just renew their agreements. And the thing about leases is that they are legal documents that are defined by their coordinates. They have to be surveyed and then have a title. And that's not the only way to do things. And on our community, we have collective ownership and individual agreements about what it is that we can have and be entitled to that is equal amongst all the members of the cooperative. So you can have agreements based partitioning of land or land use, rather than legal leases. They're just a lease is a different way of doing things that is it was designed originally as a protection, but it also meant that land could be bought and sold, but theoretically not the lease. Well, leases can be bought and sold too, but you can also have systems where only your improvements to the land can be bought and sold. That's not a lease.
Okay, all right. I think that one of the themes of the things you've been saying is that two people can have an agreement and you can work out the agreement and make it legal and come up with the ideas that you might have.
All agreements that do not violate the law are legal.
Mm, mm. Yeah. Folks, we've been talking to Brian Innes, and you're going to be here. I know this event, which is called, what's it called again? Economies for People, Not Profit. That's at 10 o'clock tomorrow. And I'm just reading off the thing here. There's a facilitated workshop conversation with you and Joe. There's a potluck lunch, and then there is an optional extra session to further explore action plans for Whangaroa. So people are invited to stay and explore topics. So that's what's happening.
We're available for Saturday and Sunday morning. So, it's up to what people, I don't at all profess to be an expert. There are loads of people with a huge amount of expertise that I don't have that can contribute, and people have got different questions to ask. And the whole thing of health systems comes within that ambit. How do we cooperatively look after each other? Mm. What are the mechanisms that we could set up that does that? And we have aging populations, and something like 300,000 people will be over the age of 80 within 30 years. Well, the government's not going to be looking after us or the next generation, for that matter. How can people do that? How can we sort that out? Because we need to, so these are all issues of economy, they're all issues of community, and we can all talk about them, and we all have our ideas.
Okay. Now, I haven't said that the location. I know that, I think it looks like you want people to sign up?
It's at the hall in town.
Okay. There's, like, we've got a What's On guide on our website, and it's got a Please Register link on it there if people want to hook up with that. And it'll be on our Facebook later today as well. And there's already, in fact, I think there's an event already on Facebook somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, Brian, well, look, thank you very much for talking to us this morning. I enjoyed the discussion, especially as I won't be here on Saturday, so I won't be able to come and have a listen. So I've made the most of my opportunity with this interview.
Such is life. Yep.
Yeah.
No, it should be quite an exciting sort of a morning, and people don't often get the opportunity to come together and have discussions like this, and that's really, it's about stimulating people and making them aware that our own creativity can throw up the solutions that we need for the future.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for your time this morning, Brian.
Pleasure. Okay.
And you're getting in the car soon and heading over, is that? Because you're not in Raglan yet, are you?
Yes. No, we're not. We're leaving somewhere around about midday.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, have a good trip.
Okay. Thanks. Bye.
All right, folks. That was Brian Innes there, and heading over with Joe soon. So that's the whole deal there. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. And you can go to our What's On guide now at raglanradio.com and already find the link into that and the write-up about it. I know it's on Facebook somewhere, and the podcast will go up later, and I think we're going to write a little bit about it as well to go with it. Anyway, that's the deal. That's the end of the show for the day, and I'll see you all again on Monday after my little short week here.